This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief at the New Books Network, and just a warning about the following interview. We had a bad phone connection, and so the audio is a little bit rough. But in any case, I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is.
Hello, and welcome to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies, where writers of African American life and culture discuss their new books. I'm your host, Sherry Johnson, and today I'm happy to speak with Aaron D. Chapman, professor in the History Department at George Washington University. Dr. Chapman is the author of new book, Prove It on Me, New Negroes, Sex, and Popular Culture in the 1920s, published by Oxford University Press in 2012. In our conversation, the professor discusses new Negroes like F.L. Waters, Oscar Michaud, Nella Larsen, or Madame C.J. Walker, just to name a few, and how they used popular culture to achieve their own goals for racial advancement and/or to hone their own ideas of self-determination. If you want to learn more about new Negroes and how they used prominent ideas about gender, race, and sexuality to sell and consume various ideas and products, Aaron D. Chapman's new book is for you. Listen in so you too can enjoy our conversation.
Good morning. Good morning, listeners. I'm Sherry Johnson, and we're speaking this morning with Dr. Aaron D. Chapman. Welcome, Aaron. How are you this morning?
I'm well. Thank you very much. And hello to the listeners.
Good, good, good. This morning, we're going to be talking a bit about Dr. Chapman's Prove It on Me, New Negroes, Sex, and Popular Culture in the 1920s. Before we begin, though, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born and raised, and how you became interested in your subject?
Okay, well, I was brought up in Dallas, Texas. Then I went to California for undergrad. And it was there that I began to take an interest in African-American gender history. And I wrote an undergraduate honors thesis with Claiborne Carson on the sort of battle and dispute between black power and black feminism in the 1960s and 70s. And I was attempting to do cultural history. I didn't really understand what it was as an undergraduate. And so that was more of an intellectual history. I used Michelle Wallace's polemic in conjunction or juxtaposition to Eldridge Cleaver's equally polemic publications. Soul on Ice versus Black Macho and the Superman. And so I went to graduate school with African American gender politics on my mind, the ideas of, you know, what does it mean to be a black woman or to be a black man, and what, in terms of gender, is the African American struggle trying to accomplish. And in graduate school, I worked with Hazel Harvey, took the introductory class with her in our African American Studies PhD program, and came to be interested in the idea of the blues woman. Mm-hmm. And I was really captivated by another seminar taught by Jonathan Holloway, with whom I also worked, in which a fellow student brought in advertisements that have since ended up in Prove It on Me. They were advertisements for race records that really did not fit the sort of Angela Davis, Hazel Harvey analysis of the blues as sung by blues women as feminist or proto-feminist, or something. Because they were cartoonish, and they contained minstrel images, and they didn't seem to be about black self-determination in any form, let alone in this form. And so I was like, well, there's a contradiction here, and I want to dig more into that and look at that. So that evolved from seminar papers and coursework research papers into a dissertation that endeavored to sort of to try to balance those impulses in the new Negro era. What is going on in terms of African American racial advancement and its gender politics? What is happening in terms of Black women's efforts at self-determination in performance and in the context of the art and representations of the period?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So you mentioned Hazel Harvey. I wonder if there, and then a few other names, I'm wondering if you could say who your mentors were. And
yes.
Whether, and I guess, I don't know, maybe whether you had any struggles with deciding to examine gender politics as your passion.
Well, first, the mentor side of the question. I worked with Matt Jacobson, Hazel Harvey, and Jonathan Hoffman. Mm-hmm. Other mentors have been Estelle Friedman and Rayburn Carson. Eula Taylor has been one of those. We so have Kira Hunter, and I recently met Jennifer Morgan. She's been really great. So sort of a broad spectrum, but certainly the main people that I worked with dissertation were those three, Matt Jacobson. Mm-hmm. In terms of studying African-American gender politics, and that's a difficult question. I think it can be a difficult thing, although we're certainly studying it from a feminist perspective, although I think that Black feminism is on the rise again in certain forms. So I certainly contribute to that and take from that. And sort of a long history of Black women's scholarship has certainly been foundational.
Yeah, good stuff. That question is one way in which I could see ambivalences that some of the new Negro women experienced be, translating to contemporary moments. So that's one of the reasons why I asked that question, because I think those ambivalences are trying to find a space in which you can speak about oppression without necessarily being nailed or named that emasculating female,
right.
Still exists. Still really, it's still a really interesting and powerful moniker to have that kind of that title. So, all right, so we'll get into that, I think, a little bit more when we talk a bit about the women who expressed or found ways to express dissatisfaction or unhappiness with the ideology, Negro progressive ideology.
Okay.
All right, so there are a couple things that drew me to your text, Erin. First of all, the cover, the picture of these women, Ethel Waters, and then your focus on popular culture and what it reveals about the new Negro and sex politics. But before we get into the heart of our discussion, I'd like to give you an opportunity to define some of the key terms that you use for your analysis. All right, in your introduction, you aptly note that the Great Migration, economics and technology, and interracial discourse on motherhood at the turn of the 20th century helped to form the sex race marketplace. Two important terms there, race motherhood and sex race marketplace. Can you share with our listeners how you define these terms?
Okay, these are discourses, in using that term discourse, I'm drawing upon the theories of principally Michel Foucault, but sort of leaving the sort of high theory aside, a discourse is a set of meanings and ideas that are dominant or hegemonic in society. So when I say that the sex race marketplace is a discourse, I mean that there is an actual market, right? Selling race records, tickets to performances, subscriptions to Opportunity magazine or the Chicago Defender or the Crisis, selling memberships to organizations like the NAACP or the National Urban League. Also selling, though, ideas along with that, right? So a subscription to the crisis, you're also buying into the idea of a certain notion of African-American advancement. You can be white or black or a member of another race, buying that subscription, buying it. And if you're buying a race record, you're also sort of buying into or wanting to participate in the performance and the idea of the blues women or the idea of the performer that's recorded there. And so it's a set of meanings, a set of ideas, a set of notions and representations to do with sexuality and race.
And race motherhood?
Race motherhood is another discourse. I see that as principally working within or among African Americans. So while the sex race marketplace was huge and sort of overarching in terms of the idea of slumming or the primitivist ideas about African Americans as closer to the earth, among African Americans themselves, as they dealt with that, those notions about themselves were very aware of them. They were also debating their own gender politics and developed what I see as a sort of rising man-centered aspiration toward patriarchy that would have black women be supportive of that. And so the idea was that the race would advance through men's advancement, men's advancement economically, men's advancement in terms of being able to be in charge of organizations, of their homes, of their families, being able to be recognized as men by the larger society, and that black women would be supportive of that, not necessarily seeking their own self-determination or advancement, but seeking to promote and help black men along with theirs. The sisters or the wives or the mothers, daughters.
Right. Important to that concept is the idea that I found in your text is the idea that it's not necessarily giving birth, although it can be that, right? It is also just taking care of, so even if you are a single female, that you are giving over yourself, individual of yourself, your own desires and your own individuality in order to contribute to the race. In this way, it's mothering as well, right?
Mothering race in the sense of, say, you're a teacher or a nurse.
That's right.
Even if you work as a secretary in a business, contributing to African American entrepreneurial, right? And you're to be subservient and supportive of your boss as not only your boss, but your patriarch, right?
Yes. That's right. That's right. Okay, good. And just so that we remember that we're speaking of a specific moment in U.S. history, right, can you say a little bit about the New Negro Movement or who was the New Negro?
Okay, yes, the New Negro era is principally formed by the Great Migration. So African Americans are moving in much larger numbers than before. I mean, they had always been on the move since emancipation.
That's right.
But they were on the move in much more significant numbers, moving from rural areas or small towns across the South into the large cities of the South, increasingly of the cities of the North and the Midwest. So moving to places like Memphis, maybe moving from Memphis to Chicago or Memphis to New York or, a migration like that. And as they moved, they're coming together in these large urban enclaves. So creating the beginnings of what become ghettos, but they're not necessarily ghettos yet, in terms of being run down in slums and neglected by city services. But they're certainly taking over large sections of cities and sort of newly visible. Wow, where are all these black people living here? Was Italian, Jewish, whatever, right? And now it's black, and what happened?
Right.
So they're conspicuous, and they're taking advantage of that conspicuousness. They're creating mass movements, so marching in the streets like the 1917 Silent Parade, that was an anti-lynching protest. They're also a new market, right? They are buying and consuming.
That's right.
They can become a consumer market to recording companies, for example, on this new product, right? Mm-hmm. They sell race records to this group of consumers, but also to white people who are interested in these conspicuous new urban black populations. What are they doing over there? What are they doing? What's the nightlife? You know, what are the dances? The outfits, the fashion, right? Mm-hmm. And so they are creating a sort of a movement out of that new modern urbanity, and that's what's new about them, right? And in contradistinction to their parents' generation, saying, you know, in the way that all new sort of up-and-coming 20-somethings and 30-somethings look at their parents and say, I don't like the way you did that, right? Like, thanks to you for supporting and raising me, but we're going to do it a little differently.
Right, right. That's the old way.
Right.
You know, I'm new. I'm modern.
As subservient in some ways, as having submitted too much to white paternalism or even to white supremacy, and they're saying, we're going to be a lot more assertive. Not necessarily militant in the way that we think of with the Black Power movement, but certainly much more unwilling to accommodate themselves.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think this part of the century, we really do begin to see protests, whether it's in literature, whether it's in film, you know, that there are individuals. I think that's a part of the new Negro era, part of the definition of who, or one of the characteristics is to protest outwardly, you know. And in that way, I mean, sure, it's not militant in the way that we normally think about it, but it certainly is resistant.
Yes.
You know, definitely.
Definitely.
Sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to elaborate a little bit, which is to say that one of the key things that I see in the New Negro era is that there are a lot of different ways to do that.
Yes.
And whereas others have seen this as primarily a middle class movement or primarily a literary movement, I don't see it so much as a movement as a generational sort of ethos, right? Mm-hmm. That encompassed African Americans across class lines and across gender lines. They're all assertive in themselves in various ways. And they didn't agree necessarily about the ways to do that. But some of them were more militant than others. Some of them were more interested in labor issues and economic issues. Some of them were more radical, some of them conservative, right?
Yeah.
So there are a lot of different ways to do that, but it's sort of a generational modernist sort of sensibility.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised at the explicitly degrading ways in which some new Negro progresses. And one of the ways that I saw, just to sit as an aside, there's a distinction that I think that you make in your text between new Negroes and new Negro progressives.
Progressives as a sort of a subset. That's one of
right. Right, exactly. Another way that another term that they reminded me of were race men, right?
Yeah.
Race men or race women. Yeah, that's one of the ways that I was able to make the distinction between or think about the diversity of ideas that existed amongst the individuals who were defined as new Negroes, right?
Yeah.
But I was really surprised at the explicit way in which new Negro progressives really spoke, you know, of the quote unquote lower grades,
yes,
of African Americans. Were you surprised as well in your research?
I'm not sure surprised would be the term. I mean, others have researched and talked about the ways in which those who saw themselves as race leaders and thought of themselves as responsible for the rest of the masses, right, really felt that African Americans, the majority of them, and especially these new migrants to the cities, weren't ready the tools and the facility that they would need to not only progress themselves, but make the race look good, right, in public space and in these other areas. So there's certainly a class bias, and I think the rising class bias as the race is developing distinct classes. In the generations before, you have very few African Americans who, in terms of what they actually earn, could really call themselves middle class. Mm-hmm. But you certainly have people who describe that. Right? But in the modern era, as the 20th century progresses, you have more and more actual economic terms and relations to the larger market and classes. So the class that already existed has more and more foundation for expression.
Right. I was also struck by how out of touch some of the new Negro progressive women. We're talking about the women here who was writing of, you know, mostly, other newly migrant, the new migrants coming from the South, how out of touch they were with the individuals that they were claiming to speak for, you know. One of the parts in your text where you talk about this is, I can't remember who it was, but she was writing about the individuals wanting to instill in them a desire for them to be consistent and develop a good work ethic. And this was, can you say a little bit more about that?
The Nachman company, I forget what the full name of the company is, but a social worker, I believe that it's Eva Bowles, of the social workers that I study. Her job is to look at this group of Black women who were newly employed in this semi-industrial company or space. And she's upset and feels that it's her mission to help them improve because they're not coming to work on time or staying for the full day, and they are not sort of working at the pace that the company would like. Mm-hmm. And so she's writing up a report in Pages of Opportunity saying what she has done to try to help ameliorate the situation. But then when you look more closely, you find that the company is not actually paying by the hour, but according to how many cushions they have completed in the course of the day. So why should they come to work, right on time at 8 or 9 or whatever the company wants,
right,
to stay all day? Why should they do the piecework according to how much money they need to make and say, well, you know, I need $5 and make 5 cushions or whatever the date was?
Yes.
But she's not seeing it from the perspective of a labor organizer, right? Mm. Perspective of the workers, but from the perspective of the company and, in a larger sense, from this sort of Negro progressive intent of making the race look good to potential workers, right? And so she does admit, okay, they need to be paid better,
right?
But she doesn't, she's really emphasizing the idea that they need to be better workers, more industrious, and more
viable, right?
Rather than the notion that, they're essentially being exploited, right?
Right.
In that sort of regular way of capitalist exploitation, mm-hmm. as women, we are paid less than the others.
It seems to me that lack of awareness, that gap between an understanding of the work perspective again, can be applied to today. I mean, I think that that's something that we hear individuals talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly can see in the discussions or the stalemates that are in Congress or whatever other levels of government. There just seems to be a lack of awareness. Okay, so that didn't surprise you. Is there something that did surprise you that you came across in your research?
Well, I think what intrigued me most, and what I go back to when I pick up the book, is the last chapter, the ways in which Black women are endeavoring to push back against two-dimensional sort of, or one-dimensional, you might say, ways of understanding them, right? And I, you know, I had been aware of Black women's fiction from the period before I started this research, but I was able to see it in a new light alongside some of the essays and the oral histories. And I really like, I think Alice Dunnigan stands out the most.
Yeah, she was really, I really enjoyed reading about her. And reading the primary quotes that you use within the text as opposed to, like, letting her speak and giving her voice was powerful.
Yeah, I mean, she's she was interviewed, this oral history that I use was taken in the 1970s. And so you can tell that the interviewer is trying to get her to say that she's a feminist, right, or that she subscribes to women's liberation as defined by the mainstream in the 1970s. And she's like, no. it's not what she's interested in. She's interested in being respected as a woman. And she does want to be taken seriously in terms of her work and in terms of her ability to determine her own destiny. And her own relationship to her husband, her community. But she also wants to be sort of supported and helped along in sort of a chivalrous way, right? Somebody across the street, cigarette lit for her. And her voice is very strong. She's very, very critical of the most did not meet any of those standards in terms of supportive or of being respectful of her intention to determine her own role in the world.
Yes, I'm your host, Sherry Johnson, and you're listening to New Books in African American Studies through the New Books Network. And today we're speaking with Dr. Erin D. Chapman about her text, Prove It On Me, New Negroes, Sex, and Popular Culture in the 1920s. All right, and Annie Dunnigan, really, her story really was a nice culminating point for me that kind of clarified one story that clarified for me that Black women during the New Negro era really were between a rock and a hard place. I guess I noted that there were so many incongruities that you noted within the movement, right, for racial advancement. And I'm speaking here, for example, of New Negro men using early Black feminist anti-lynching, you know, ideology to reinforce patriarchal ideas for racial advancement. Can you talk a little bit about such, you know, oddities or contradictions?
Yes, I mean, I assume you're speaking of Oscar Michaud, and filmmaker, who I analyze his second film, Within Our Gates, at some length in chapter one. And I guess I don't see that so much as a contradiction as a transition that is aware of and drawing upon the anti-lynching ideology that's there, that was principally laid out by Ida B. Wells and taken up by the National Association of Colored Women. And, you know, he's drawing upon that and pointing out what they pointed out. He's using film to sort of show us that lynching is often accompanied by rape, that these are forms of terror practiced against African Americans, not because of Black men being accused of raping white women. The idea that Black men are rapists, but more importantly, because in reaction to any sign of African-American economic competition or political self-assertion. And so he utilizes that. He shows, juxtaposes the lynching of Jasper Landry and Mrs. Landry against the attempted rape of their daughter, Sylvia. But he does that in a flashback sequence. The lynching takes place in a flashback in a larger film that really is much more about the cure for all of this, right? Which is the coming to prominence of the new Negro, right? This new personality who is Dr. Vivian, the character in the film, who is highly educated, who is committed to African-American racial advancement, who has the wherewithal, because of his education, because of his lack of vulnerability, has the wherewithal to not be a victim and not allow those connected to him to be victimized. And Sylvia, our ostensible protagonist, ends up married to Dr. Vivian. And at the end of the film, after he has heard this story of her secret shame, which is this, my man turned out to be your father, actually.
Right.
Sort of this race melodrama.
Right.
secrets revealed and all of that kind of thing. And so he's heard this story, and his answer to her is to be proud of her, of our country, that she can contribute as his tender wife, and that she has been, she's going to be a good patriot, and but she has been thinking, her thinking has been warped.
Right. Yeah, that was the language, right.
right. And so here he is. He's the right thinker. He has, he and other African-American men have defended the country. You know, it's this weird sort of patriotic proposal, right? You will always be a patriot and a tender wife.
Right.
List these battles from World War One and from the Spanish-American War, in which Black men participated. And so, you know, I'm trying to make sense of this. It seems to me that what is happening is that he is declaring, and the show through him is declaring the rise of this new Negro patriarch who can protect the country, who can protect the race, who can protect the Sylvias of the race, right? And lead the way forward. So she accepts that her thinking has been warped. She holds his hand. They together look out into this brighter day, future through this sort of lighted window in the final scene. Yes, Michelle recognizes that that this lynching politics has occurred according to this rape lynch discourse, right?
Yeah.
That has been prominent in the past. He accepts Ida B. Wells and the National Association of Colored Women's interpretation of lynching. But his remedy, right, is the rise of this Negro patriarchy.
Right, right. And that's...
So it's a transitional moment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it certainly is a transitional moment. And that's the tension that I'm talking about, that his compliance with what she says, you know, what Ida B. Wells outlines, but that in the end, the twist to this is why we ought to support patriarchal ideologies for racial advancement, that's where the tension is for me. That's where that contradiction comes in, or maybe irony, I don't know, but it's just funny to me that you're utilizing this woman who went out. She was a wife, yes, but she was also working a race woman.
Yes.
But the solution that ultimately comes at the end is stay home, be a good wife, be a good race mother, and we'll take care of the business. Just support us. You know, that's the irony or tension that I'm talking about. And it's, you know, repeats, I think, throughout, as we continue to look at your analysis of the you know, sex race marketplace and how women were able to create a space for themselves in between these tensions. I guess another good example that you highlight is the desire for Black bodies as commodities, how that desire opens up spaces for Blacks to be viewed as human beings, but simultaneously allows for the dehumanization of Black bodies.
Yes, right. So one of the things that I think results from this great migration and this new conspicuousness of African Americans is that people want to see actual Black bodies, you know, whereas before, it was all about the minstrel show, right? Mm-hmm. And basically, it was Black performers dressing up in blackface, right? Mm-hmm. And tap dancing, or, you know, doing these sort of vaudeville sort of skits and this kind of performance. Mm-hmm. And so these weren't actual, I mean, they were actual Black people, but they had to disguise themselves to fit this stage or plantation stereotype, mm-hmm. right? Particularly nostalgia. Whereas in the modern era, viewers want to see actual Black bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they are there. They're in photographs, sort of splashed across the periodicals. They're in performances on stage and screen, and they're sometimes comedic. They're sometimes extremely sexy. And that's new, right? Because Mammy, you know, he's not sexy, right?
It's definitely not sexy.
Right, that's the whole thing about Mammy, is that she doesn't have a sexuality except as a mother to these white children or white women who are their charges, right? So, yes, they get to be visible, they get to be sexy, they get to be divas, they're singing on race records, they're the focus of these advertisements, and yet they immediately fall into this next sort of one-dimensional space where they're hypersexualized, right? Through this primitivism that's at work in this period. And we see that in the ways that the recording companies chose to advertise them. And, you know, so they're highly sexualized or hypersexualized. They're also, companies, these white-owned companies are also utilizing the very language of self-determination.
That's right, yeah. I found that to be really fascinating. We're talking about Columbia and then the other, you know, white-owned companies.
And also,
Pluco hairdressing and
Golden Brown.
That's right, Golden Brown Beauty Preparations.
Who has created this whole character, this fiction, as far as this researcher is named, Madam Mamie Hightower, right? Who's supposed to be this entrepreneurial success story to rival Madison J. Walker.
Yeah.
But who didn't exist, or she did exist, and she may have been the wife of this man named Zach Hightower, of the drug company that owned the Golden Brown Company in Memphis. But, you know, this entrepreneur who's created this line of products and who is selling them, right, in the tradition of Madam C.J. Walker.
Right, for our race and our woman. And
exactly.
I just thought it was so fascinating the way that, and just raises, okay, I thought it was fascinating the way in which these white-owned companies were utilizing the rhetoric of the new Negro progressivism, for their own, you know, for their own capitalistic ventures.
Absolutely.
And it speaks to some things that you raise in terms of ownership and control. I want to talk about that shortly. But just looking at the ads in your text, you do a really good job of inserting these primary documents, these ads, advertisements themselves, and we can see the way in which these caricatures or cartoons are very much a part of the ad, but then you have a little inset of the real, you know, Bessie Smith or Clara Smith, but everything else is a cartoon.
Right. And a cartoon that is really deprecatory. I mean,
oh yes, yes, yes. Sambo-like, right? In that tradition,
right, right. And you know, they're roots, I call them, right? I mean, they're country. They're modern and sophisticated. They are in mismatched outfits, and they have their hair all over their head. You know, which is a phrase that my mother and grandmother use, right? You know, they're not coiffed and dressed, right? Fashionable in the way that the blues women were, right, when they performed, or in those little headshots, you know, if you could see them, then you could see that they were, you know, larger than life, and their sort of extreme diva glamour, right? But that's not the primary image that you get. The primary image that you get is of these sort of backwards country folk, right? Hey, I mean, you know, it's not as if African-American buyers or consumers, especially those who were recent migrants, may not have laughed along with the sort of comedic
intent.
They might have seen something of themselves or their cousins, or, you know, that's what I was like when I first got to the city. I'm just so glad I'm, you know, dressed right now, or, you know.
Right.
But they function overall in this way to, right, to shrink the significance of this effort at self-determination that these blues women,
right,
it shrinks the significance, and highlights this whole world of black deviance, right, unsuitability for modern life. And so, you know, black people, you know, have these weird relationships where the woman has a cleaver and she's chasing her boyfriend down the street and he's running from her. She's so much bigger than him. He's smaller than her. Right.
Cowering and sweating. And,
right. You know, right. So these backwards relationships, these deviant people with their country talk, and you see the script in some of those ads, you know, they're very much using some sort of white idea of what black slang might or might not be.
Right.
And maybe they get it right, maybe they don't. In some instances they do, in some instances they don't, whatever. But the point is that they are imposing these notions on Americans and representing that that way in periodicals and in these public spaces.
Yeah, I wonder, in reading it, a question that I had was, I wonder how aware individuals were of the distinction between the white, with this kind of strategy, right, in terms of using the rhetoric of racial advancement, how aware the masses were, the public was, of which ones were white-owned companies versus which ones were not.
Right. I'm not sure, but I know that in doing my research with the Madam C.J. Walker Company, their archives are in Indiana, and I came across some bits of things that I wasn't able to amass enough to put into the book itself, but bits of things that suggested that the Walker Company, at least, was making a real effort to combine with other actually black-owned companies. To try to have the public understand which ones were the real
That's right.
New Negro sort of entrepreneurial efforts and which ones were not.
Yes.
And it's not clear at all how far they got with that or the success that they had with sending that message out. But they were trying to do that, and they were also trying to make their consumers aware of what their actual packaging looked like, because they knew that they would be copied.
Yeah. I mean, it's so evident. It's so obvious the ways in which they were appropriating, you know, particularly Golden Brown.
Mm-hmm.
It's just appropriating Madam C.J. Walker's strategies for selling her products. And so I'm not surprised at all that she is a businesswoman. I mean, it's not odd to me that she understands what's going on and would try to create some kind of strategy by which she can let the public know what's going on.
I mean, she died in 1919, but it's certainly the company's policy and efforts. They are using her story of Greg's British success, using her strategies well into the 1920s and the early 30s.
Well, one thing we can definitely see if we look at Oscar Michaud, if we're looking at the Brooklyn Nation, if we're looking at these ads, is the power of the image, the power of image to, in terms of self-determination, but also to put out an idea that's out. I mean, how effective it is, how effective some people's efforts were can be questioned, but the power of the image or visual text cannot be, you know, disputed, right, within at this time, and obviously today. It's a no-brainer. One of the things that I wanted to, that struck me was some text by Golden Brown. I want to read it here and ask your thoughts on this. You say here on page 101, as you're quoting a Golden Brown ad, that pride in our race demands that we look light, bright, and attractive. End quote. And I thought, goodness, you know, we know that within our folklore there's this language of, you know, light is right, you know, light bright is right. And I'm wondering, I just started thinking, I wonder where that language came from. Did it come from, you know, this white owned company that put that out there, or is it something that they're clinging to and then appropriating?
Well, I think that they are appropriating and utilizing what they know to already be there. I certainly don't think that colorism, right, as well, you know, defines that term, was invented, right? Certainly there before, well before. But I think that there's something about commodifying colorism, right? And I wonder if it seems to me that the part of this is the idea that to be lighter is somehow to be more modern.
Yeah.
So we talked about Mammy before, and of course Mammy's always very dark skinned, right? And so is Uncle Tom, right? And Aunt Jemima. And you know, the Aunt Jemima ads are huge in this period. And so Mammy, in some ways, is overshadowing everything. And so I wonder if part of this emphasis on light skin is also this idea of what it means to be modern, as well as what it means to be supposedly more attractive, or
yes,
here, or you know. There's also a piece of that, like the dancers who danced at the Cotton Club. As the jazz performances were going on, right? And segregated, this is one of the segregated venues in Harlem, where white people get to be in the audience watching black performers.
Right.
And, you know, those dancers have to be a certain color. So what is it that white people are watching when they're watching light-skinned black women legs? It seems to me that part of what they're watching is some notion, some sort of what may have been sexy or titillating idea of the results of miscegenation, the results of amalgamation, right?
Yes, sure. You know, so one way that black women dealt with the incongruities, right, the tensions between the power of the image and then the other side of what it could do, which is, you know, causing the dehumanization of their black bodies. One of the ways that black women dealt with it was through what you call a culture of dissemblance.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the culture of dissemblance? Yeah.
Right. I mean, I'm utilizing Darlene Kleister.
Okay.
And I'm positing that companies like the Madam C.J. Walker Company or Black women and Black people at large who wanted to, were mindful of this hypersexualization and didn't want to contribute to it, attempted to dissemble their sexualities, particularly in terms of what they were going to represent in terms of advertisements and images in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So I don't find the Madam C.J. Walker Company using large photographs or right, representing actual Black people. They show either drawings of their products and their packages, right? Again, to have their public understand what that package looks like, right? Buy it in the marketplace. Also, images of sort of angels delivering the packages. You know, just items. They're on a missionary.
That's right. Hey, that really struck me, is that rhetoric that was clear in Madam C.J. Walker's ads of her doing God's work, essentially, and encouraging agents to think of themselves as missionaries going to convert the masses.
Yes. I think there's something, quite simply, there's a rhetoric already there. Right, like how do you approach people that you don't know to get them to do something? Right, there's a method to that Black people might have been familiar to Black people already that comes out of the church, right? Mm-hmm. Right, or proselytizing. Right? There's also, I think, a real resistance to this idea of making it clear that they're giving Black women, in particular, a means of making themselves sexier or more proactive, more independent in terms of their sexuality. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's not what we're doing.
Right. Right.
To be upset about that, that kind of notion. No, we're improving the health of the race as a whole.
That's right.
Look better, look more respectable, healthier, have healthier skin and scalps. Mm-hmm. And can advance the race in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really got that rhetoric down good, right?
and that's, that's one of the points that I come back to a lot of smile. I see it as really savvy. I won't say manipulative because that word it has a negative connotation.
Right.
Perhaps it shouldn't because it's just what you do as a savvy business person.
Right. Right. And paying attention to behaviors, habits. And what was so fascinating to me, again, is that tension or that maybe the irony of the use of the culture of dissemblance. But Madam C.J. Walker is a businesswoman, a very successful businesswoman. So it's who she is in reality is very much a different persona than what is being put out in the ads. Similarly, you talked a little bit about this with Evelyn Prayers. How do you say her last name?
Prayer.
Right, in Oscar Micheaux's Within Our Gates, when she's giving her interviews, she's there. She has a persona.
Yes.
Right?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very flapper, very sexy, cute, flirtatious.
Mm-hmm. And distinct from who she is, and she's very good at keeping the public at bay in terms of who she was in her private life versus what was on her public persona.
Right. And both of those are very distinct from Sylvia Landry.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, she's the sort of sexy flapper, not hypersexual, right? But also not sort of staid and conservative and victimized.
Right, right, like Sylvia Landry. But would you say that the culture of dissemblance is something that new Negro women had to engage in? Given the stringent didactic spaces in which they were allowed to be,
I think that it's one method. It's a method that is inherited from their mother's generation. I see them pushing back against it in a number of ways, right? So Madam C.J. Walker and the Walker Company are utilizing it, but as I say in that chapter 3, there are women who are doing something entirely different, right? So in that chapter, you get to Nora Holt, who's naked, right?
Right.
Naked.
Just completely. That's true. I mean,
and offering herself, right?
Right.
And would dance naked at parties and, just had a really good time with playing with her sexuality, right? And married 5 times and was just really not interested in any of that. It's cultural things, right?
Right, right. Kind of. I cracked up at your, when you noted the difference between Jesse Fawcett and Nella Larson and your use of their relationship or their perception of Nora Holt to kind of highlight their own personalities.
Right, right. So that, Jesse Fawcett, so Nora Holt gets naked and dances at a party that is an after-hours party for Paul Robeson and his singing partner after a concert that they have given. Nora Holt is, I sort of picture her in my mind. There's nothing suggesting that she's actually up on a table, but that's how I picture her. She certainly danced nude. And Carl Van Vechten, who's also there, reports that Jesse Fawcett almost expired, right? So shocked and horrified that Nora Holt would do this, right?
Right.
And Ella Larson makes friends with Nora Holt.
Right. Great. Oh, yeah, that was great.
Pretty interesting.
Very funny. Very good.
I would like to say that also highlights something else that's happening, because Jessie Fawcett, she acts like sort of a snob and a prude in that particular situation, or at least that's what Carl Van Vechten reports.
Right.
And yet in her novel, Plum Bun, she's certainly not a prude. Right. Not in what she has her main character engaged in. So, she doesn't go as far as Nella Larson in her critique of patriarchy or of marriage, but she certainly is not having Angela ignore or dissemble her sexuality.
Right. Right. So there's definitely a connection between ownership and control, some kind of relationship that you draw between ownership and control of one's images. And Nora Holt, one of the things that you say later in the book is that, if we look at the exploitation of the far-reaching sex race marketplace, there's a quote from your book. If we look at that, then we say that, new Negro women did not completely control the sociocultural effects or the uses made of their sexuality or images of their sexuality. But then when you talk about Nora Holt, a quote that I'm going to quote you here. You say, Holt surely enjoyed her manipulation of the marketplace's ingrained hypersexualization of Black women. Fearlessly, she took that representation in her hands, molded and maximized it to augment her reputation as a vamp, her fun, and her income. So, I guess, end quote. Would you say then that she is in control of her image, or she owns it? Certainly, maybe that she controls it. But would you say that she owns it?
I would say that she owns it to the extent that we all own our images, but that there's always a tension, right? And an increased tension for Black women because of the difference that race and sex and sexual oppression make, right? That she takes what's already there, right? So already Black women are sort of, to say, it's like coded, right, in sex race. People are already seeing them through it, right? They can't control that, right? She can't control that. So instead of fighting it, dissembling or doing yourself in this proper way or, trying to wind her way through it, she's just like, yeah.
Right.
sexy. I'm ready. You know, let's go.
Right.
And that's what she's selling in part. I mean, she's not a prostitute and she's not a booze woman strictly, but she is somebody who performed at parties. She's a musician. She's a singer.
Right.
She also has lots of friends and, you know, is known sort of, you know, she's one of those people that you invite to the party because you know that she's going to be seen.
Right.
The way that's fun.
I'm wondering if, you know, one of the things that you noticed that she was not lacking for money, she was left a nice inheritance from her husband, her first husband, and yet still she worked and had fun and things like that. And I wonder if her financial freedom afforded her the ability to be free in her embracing or utilizing or exploiting the sexualized images of Black women out there for her own benefit. What do you think?
It may be that she felt freer because she didn't, she wasn't going to be impoverished.
Right.
I don't think that her inheritance from that first husband was enough so that she could live really high.
Oh, okay.
Without making some other money. I think that she definitely wasn't going to be impoverished, but at the same time, she wants to, you know, she travels the world. She performs in Tokyo. She's off to Paris. Mm-hmm. She's living high life in New York.
Mm-hmm.
She had to work some in order to, or be attached to some new guy.
You, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And she does all of that, it seems to me. You know, I don't think she is bothered much by these questions of respectability or representation that are so important to some of her contemporaries. And that can be so important to a lot of Black people's
coming. Right. Well, Nora Holt was most definitely guilty of the sin of individuality, as you note in as a quote from your book, The Sin of Individuality, which I really liked. Even though there were women who were compliant with masculinism, you note later in the book, your entire last chapter really focuses on the dissatisfaction that we find in, you know, Marita Bonner's essays and Jesse Fawcett and Nella Larson's art.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk a little bit about their expressions of unhappiness?
Yes, I think that they all recognize to one degree or another that they're not being known, they're not understood by their society at large. And that to some extent, the prevalent African-American racial advancement effort of the era, with its focus on men, manhood, is not helping them be better.
Right.
There are degrees, right? I don't posit or understand there to be an overarching sort of Negro feminist movement.
Right, 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 yeah.
There are individual feminists.
Right.
And I think Nella Larson is certainly one of them.
Sure.
I could say that from a certain perspective that at least Johnson Engel was one of them.
Right.
Permitted as she was.
Mm-hmm.
They're not gathering together in a feminist movement, but they are mounting sort of quiet protests,
mm-hmm. right?
And quiet efforts to say, no, we're more complicated than this,
right? Mm-hmm.
Or I question this, or what about this? Like, if Marita Bonner seems to be saying, well, really, do I have to go down south and teach or do something to my people? I recognize that that's what I should do, that's what expected of me. Do I really want to do that? I don't know.
Right.
And so there were different responses to that question, but I think that it's the determination to ask the question that is big. And that's what I'm trying to draw out, these questions and the different responses to those questions.
Yeah.
So one of the oral histories is of a woman named Melnita Cass, who seemed, from her interview and her her story of her life, perfectly happy to be at home taking care of the children. Her husband was one of the Pullman porters. She was involved in volunteer networks, but she did not work outside home. And she did not object in any way to her husband's request or perhaps demand that she stay home and take care of the children and make that her primary effort. Mm-hmm. She was happy with that. It's fine. And so it's not that there weren't women who were happy with that, and that's not part of the New Negro era as well, because it certainly is. But it's the question, right? It's the generation of women saying, well, I could work. Or, well, I don't know if patriarchy is what I want my marriage to look like. Right?
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so one of the last questions I want to ask you here kind of gives you an opportunity to talk about the art form that, just kind of going along with this question of dissatisfaction, what is it about the fine arts that allows people like, you know, Jesse Fawcett or Nella Larson to, or the blues, any of the blues women, right, to explore a more complex image of black women? Overwhelmingly, we find that it is in the fine arts that these women are presenting themselves as more complex, not necessarily themselves, but their characters or their personas, right? What is it about the fine arts that allows that space?
Well, I think that in any era, in the Western world, we consider the arts to be a space of exploration. So that's sort of the foundation here, right? To a novelist or a poet, right, is dreaming a world, right? And sort of holding up a mirror in a certain way, and saying, well, what about this, you know, in contradistinction to the world that we know, and see something else. And likewise with plays or performance, and that's why we're drawn, I think, to music or to the arts in general. So I think that that's a basis there, that's always the case with the arts. And I think that this recognition, right, that New Negro women had with that opportunity allows them to say, okay, well, in my real life, I've got to conform to a certain degree, right, or else perhaps be ostracized or not considered to be part of the group, and that's a little scary. Mm-hmm. But here, in this fictional space, where, okay, I'm going to, or, you know, as I write this music, right, I get to express myself in a way that's not, it's not necessarily available to me in public space, that I'm going to have, continue to have the relationships that I've been accustomed to and that are valuable to me. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that definitely makes sense, for sure. I just wanted to, and I think it'll make sense to a lot of our listeners. I guess one of the things that, excuse me, I'm thinking is just that we need to, what I'm hoping that people take away is that we need to continue to emphasize the fine arts as a space of exploration and freedom, a space wherein one, you know, if you don't necessarily have a room of your own in literally, at least you can within the space of the fine art that existed then and it still exists now as a place where one can explore possibilities, right, through fictional, through personas. So you've been listening to Dr. Erin D. Chapman discuss her book, Prove It On Me, New Negroes, Sex, and Popular Culture in the 1920s, here on New Books in African American Studies. I'm your host, Sherry Johnson. And before we close, Erin, I'd love to hear what you're working on now.
Well, I am fascinated by Lorraine Hansberry. I came to her as part of preliminary research I'm doing on a possible next book project, A Long History of Black Feminism, from 1890. I hope to look at Black feminist expression and its history as a facet of the racial advancement movement at large. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm going to write that whole book, but right now I'm really fascinated by Lorraine Hansberry. And her, she seems to me to be attempting to cobble together a means of addressing both racism and sexism simultaneously. And I think her art, one of the things that fascinates me is that when she is interviewed about the raising of the son and her other plays, she emphasizes the women characters. And she seems to me to be positing them as the primaries for movers and shakers, themes as she sees her mom, which of course is not the way that it's usually understood.
That's right. Well, yeah.
And so I'm fascinated by that. So I wouldn't look more closely at her papers and her journals, and you know, she seemed to just sit down at the typewriter sometimes and type up her thoughts in some of the journal. Just read her thoughts, and so there's lots there to sort of dig through and get to know her.
Well, good luck with that. I mean, we definitely look forward to seeing what you come up with next. And if it's anything like Prove It On Me, we know that it's going to be excellent and critical and interesting as well. So thank you so much for speaking with us today. Wish you all the very best.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you.
I'm Sherry Johnson, host of the interview series New Books in African American Studies, and you've been listening to my conversation with Dr. Erin D. Chapman, where we discuss her new book, Prove It On Me, New Negroes, Sex, and Popular Culture in the 1920s. I hope you'll join me next time.